May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm here on behalf of Attain Specialty Insurance Company, and this case comes before you on an appeal from the trial court's order regarding garnishment action in a garnishment action. That action is a Rule 90 garnishment action coined as a writ of garnishment in aid of execution. That is a limited procedural action which follows the entry of a judgment in a tort case. In this case, that tort action arises out of a shooting that occurred at an apartment complex called the Sheridan Apartments. My client, Attain Specialty, insured the Sheridan Apartments. The facts and circumstances regarding the shooting are in dispute, to say the least, but suffice it to say, on the evening of June 10th, 2012, Franklin Allen was shot while at the Sheridan Apartments by an individual named Wayne Briers. The Sheridan Apartments were owned by an individual named John Frank, and John Frank denies that Wayne Briers was in the course and scope of his employment at the time of that shooting. What ultimately happens is that the shooting occurs, and the lawyer for Franklin Allen gives notice to John Frank, the owner of the apartment complex, of an intent to file a lawsuit. Attain Specialty ultimately gets notice of it through their named insured, John Frank, and sends out what's customarily done is a reservation of rights letter. And what they do is, based on their investigation to date, they outline the potential coverage issues under the policy, including the intentional acts exclusion, the assault and battery exclusion, whether an occurrence occurred under the policy, and then whether or not Mr. Briers qualifies as an insured under the policy. That letter went out in September of 2012. Subsequent to that letter going out in November of 2012, the insured, and again, no tort action has been filed at this point in time, and that letter that was sent to both Mr. Briers and Mr. Frank indicated that if a lawsuit was filed, that they should immediately let Attain know. Attain would like a copy of the lawsuit. Attain would provide a defense subject to all those coverage issues outlined in that letter. Then come November of 2012, Attain learns that the insured, or alleged insured, Mr. Briers, has entered into an 065 agreement with the plaintiff, Franklin Allen. And again, this is before a tort action is filed. What ultimately happens is in December that tort action is filed. Attain learns of the tort action, not because Wayne Briers, the alleged insured, comes to Attain and says, hey, provide me with a defense, here's the lawsuit. Instead, what happens is Attain learns of the lawsuit, hires a lawyer to defend Mr. Briers, and that lawyer proceeds to attempt to make contact with Mr. Briers so they can discuss the defense of the case. He's unable to ever have a meeting with Mr. Briers, and ultimately what happens is that lawyer, in order to protect Mr. Briers' interests, files an answer. And that answer is filed in January of 2013 on the last day to file an answer under the rules. He files an answer. It's a general denial that says he denied, you know, the allegations in the petition. The Briers personal counsel then sends a letter to that lawyer and says, we're not willing to accept your defense. We've entered into an 065 and we'll be consenting to judgment. The lawyer withdraws the next day. 5 days later, Wayne Briers files a notice of consent to judgment. That is filed in January of 2013. Ultimately, despite the filing of that consent to judgment, and a trial, so to speak, is held in April of 2013. And that trial consists of stipulations that are made between Briers and Allen regarding the underlying incident. And the stipulations are essentially all the stipulations that would be related to coverage. There was no assault. There was no battery. This was an accidental shooting. He was in the course and scope of his employment. He was required to provide security to the property. He was doing that at the time of the accident, at the time of the shooting. All of those facts, despite the fact that what the evidence and what the police report, which the insurance company obtained immediately after receiving notice of it, says, what happened here is there was an argument where Mr. Briers and Mr. Allen were arguing. It became heated. It turned physical. It turned physical when Mr. Allen began punching Mr. Briers, Ultimately, Mr. Briers pulled out a gun and shot Mr. Allen. One of the eyewitnesses to the accident, Eileen Starks, her affidavit is included in the summary judgment record. She actually recorded it all on her cell phone. And
there wasn't a criminal action, though, that you're claiming is...
You're correct, Your Honor. There was not a criminal action. And
so there's lots of things in police reports, and there's lots of different positions by different parties.
Well, quite frankly, in the police report, every statement, including the statement of the alleged insured, Mr. Briers, is that this was that Mr. Allen Mr. Allen punched him, that there was an argument, that Mr. Allen began punching Mr. Briers, and then the shooting occurred. And so that is, there isn't even Mr. Briers' statement during the police investigation
was
that.
Did you bring a deck action immediately to determine coverage?
We attempted to bring a declaratory judgment action in federal court, and that was filed in October of 2012 to determine whether or not there was duties under the policy. Mm-hmm. That is correct.
I know you're going through the facts, so I don't want you to run out of time. You filed a motion to intervene that was denied, but you did not appeal that. What effect does that have on your case?
You know what, Your Honor, that's a very good question. I don't think it has an effect, because here's the situation. The first motion to intervene was filed before the tort action was reduced to a judgment. And the case law is very clear that there is no right to intervene until it's reduced to a judgment and the insurance company is called upon to make payment. The subsequent motion to intervene was filed after.
Is there any case that lets you intervene afterwards in the underlying action?
There are, Your Honor, and I apologize that I don't have them in front of me, but I think that maybe the Ballmer case suggests that, and maybe Whitehead, but I certainly have cited those in my brief, that suggest that once the insurance company is called upon to make indemnity obligations, becomes
in
right.
In response to the garnishment or in a separate deck action, but actually in the underlying to intervene formally in the underlying action? Okay.
Correct. And so what ultimately, let me just tell you, to be frank, what's happened here is we get a garnishment action where there was an agreement to stay the proceedings. Despite that agreement, the plaintiff files a motion for summary judgment. It's supported by half of the fact. There's, I think, 26 statements of uncontroverted fact. Half of them are either not supported or supported by unauthenticated evidence, and then attain response to that summary judgment motion, putting forth substantial evidence as to each and every one of those issues, ultimately controverting those issues, but also asserting 33 additional statements of uncontroverted fact, to which there was no response filed. The summary judgment motion doesn't address any of Attain's affirmative defenses. I think the case of Taggart is directly on point that says, in a garnishment action, the plaintiff bears the burden to negate each and every one of those affirmative defenses. The motion for summary judgment doesn't address any of the affirmative defenses, despite Attain's raising of those affirmative defenses. I would submit to the court that this case is resulted in a substantial injustice, something that I've never seen under Missouri law before, quite frankly. Ultimately, what we have is an insurance company being compelled to pay a $16 million judgment in an action that it never had any opportunity whatsoever to litigate whether there was an assault, whether there was a battery, whether there was an intentional act, whether there was an occurrence, or whether the alleged insured was even in the course and scope of his employment. They didn't have an opportunity to defend the underlying action. I would submit that the facts establish that conclusively, but at a minimum, it would be a question of fact that would preclude summary judgment.
What is it you allege you get to relitigate, and what is it you're bound by failing to provide a defense?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. I think that the case law is very clear that if an insurance company has an opportunity to defend and fails to defend, it is bound by determinations of liability, in other words, negligent or not, or whatever the cause of action is, liability, and the amount of damages. Now, that key is an opportunity to defend, which doesn't exist in this case, and also in the absence of fraud or collusion, which there's ample evidence to suggest fraud and collusion in this case, at a minimum, to create a question of fact that would preclude summary judgment. Those would be those issues that would be, if those two issues were met, then there would be the finding nature of the ultimate liability and
damages. You're not suggesting it's fraud to take advantage of the statute, are you?
Not to take advantage of the statute, but what we have here is essentially a stipulation between two complete strangers to an insurance policy, all to create coverage under a policy that wouldn't otherwise exist. Those stipulations, even in light of the testimony of the insured, the alleged insured, Briars, the named insured, John Frank, and Allen, do not support the stipulations that were made in the underlying action. It was clearly done for purposes of creating coverage where it wouldn't otherwise exist, despite the insurance company's attempts to intervene to litigate those and subsequent attempts to litigate those. It's never been provided that opportunity. I think that one of the cases that is telling out of this court is James versus Paul, which is a collateral estoppel case. I submit that we don't even have to get there because of the procedural posture of this case. But even if we start talking about the underlying trial court findings, the James versus Paul case suggests and establishes that the insurance company under this situation would absolutely be entitled to an opportunity to litigate facts regarding its coverage issues. There was no way, even if it had an opportunity to defend, that it could have defended and said, hey, you know what? He wasn't in the course and scope of his employment. Hey, you know what? He was actually intentionally shooting him. They couldn't have come in and presented those facts in defending Mr. Briars. There was no opportunity there to do that, even if they had defended. The other issue is that under Missouri law, the duty to defend is determined by the allegations in the complaint and the other information that's known or discoverable at the time the complaint is filed. In this case, the arguments that the plaintiffs made and that the trial court found are all finding of a breach of the duty to defend based on the trial court's findings in the underlying judgment. Those findings are not controlling
now,
on the duty to defend.
Now, is this the right place in the garnishment? Isn't there an equitable action, or could you have filed an action to set aside the judgment or arguing the same things you're doing now? Garnishment generally is just sort of a ministerial act to collect on a judgment. You're challenging the judgment. Were there no other equitable actions you could have filed to set aside the judgment, almost like a default judgment?
Well, I think that the issue was that there has been those actions filed, but also that was raised in the garnishment action as an affirmative defense. There was a motion to intervene to set aside that. I think that that would cover the basis, but additionally, there was a subsequent action in federal court filed to establish the fraud and collusion issues.
And why in federal court, and what happened there? Remind me.
Ultimately, they abstained based on pendency of this case.
And was that surprising to you? Why file it in federal court?
what diversity? I mean, I think that I've got an insurance company that's a stranger to this state, quite honestly, and we would like our day in court. We haven't been able to obtain that day in court, and we're doing our best to get an opportunity
to
be heard.
Did you appeal the federal decision, or did you appeal any?
It's simply a dismissal without prejudice, so I assume that once this action is resolved, that ultimately could be refiled. That's at this point, if I were to refile it now, they would continue to dismiss it. And I would say that.
And you're litigating the same issues right now.
Well, not quite honestly. I think the issue in this case is simply limited to, does this insurance policy provide coverage for the amount of the policy limit of $1 million? I don't think that this court should reach the issue of breach of the duty to defend or breach of the duty to indemnify. The issue in this limited procedural Rule 90 garnishment action is, does the policy
provide
coverage?
Well, but that's very relevant. You want to litigate as part of coverage all the underlying issues in the tort suit, and that whether you get to do that very much depends on whether you breach the duty to defend.
Well,
and
quite honestly, that's why I think the issue is that. That's why I think the issue and what has always been tried to be done in this case is that these issues be resolved in a declaratory judgment action, because that allows us to litigate all of these other issues. The case law is very clear that in a Rule 90 the writ of garnishment action, you're limited to the sole determination of what property in the possession of the garnishee is owed at the present time.
Did you file a declaratory judgment action?
I'm sorry, what?
Did you file the declaratory judgment action?
Yes, we filed two declaratory judgment actions.
And what happened to those?
The first declaratory judgment action was dismissed out of abstention based on the filing of the plaintiff's declaratory judgment. So the plaintiff also filed a declaratory judgment action So the federal one was dismissed in lieu of that one. Then the subsequent declaratory judgment, plaintiff's declaratory judgment action, was ultimately dismissed when the trial court in the garnishment, this is so confusing, I'm sorry, but when the trial court in the garnishment case entered its judgment, that court dismissed the second declaratory judgment action, which was filed by the plaintiff. A third declaratory judgment action was since filed and has since been dismissed by the court. So there's been a total of three declaratory judgment actions.
And they were all dismissed without prejudice?
Yes, because at this time, the way that the trial court judgment reads, which I would submit to the court is beyond the jurisdiction of the trial court in this Rule 90 action, is that all of these issues are determined.
Again, how can they determine coverage without determining what you can relitigate and what you can't? So,
well, that's different. Determining what you can relitigate and what you can't is different than whether or not you breach the duty to defend or you breach the duty to indemnify.
Well, what you can relitigate depends on whether you breach the duty to defend in part. So I'm not clear how you're separating those.
Well, actually, I would say that I don't think it's if you breach the duty to defend. It's simply if you had the opportunity to defend. That's what the cases even say. It's not whether or not you had the right to defend, it's whether you had the opportunity to defend. I will submit that the overwhelming evidence in this case establishes that Attain never had a single opportunity to defend this case. When the tort action was filed, the 065 agreement was already in place where the insured had consented to liability or consented to judgment against him.
So you're not saying because there were conflicting allegations and evidence as to negligence and intentional acts that you had an opportunity to defend, but just you didn't get notice until too late of the suit?
Well, I mean, that was, we didn't have an opportunity to defend the underlying action because of that, because the 065 agreement was already in place. The insured never requested us to defend the action. We tried to defend the action, and
we
were going to
say you had notice and entered an appearance and then withdrew. So,
well, we withdrew when the insured demanded that we withdraw, and there was never an opportunity. I think the case law suggests that an insured obviously cannot be compelled to accept the reservation of rights defense. And I acknowledge that. The unfortunate thing with that is ultimately that ability of an insured to either accept or reject the reservation of rights dictates whether there's going to be coverage under the policy.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, there's lots of cases saying you take your chances if you reserve your rights and you get to litigate coverage. And if you were right, you know, you win. And
but
if you weren't, you
lose. Let me just explain
and
this.
But you didn't file in state court. You filed in federal court when there was a pending state action. So.
Well, not actually.
It's sounding like, and we'll study that.
Sure, but can I address the issue?
Absolutely.
Because I think that when I say that the insured's right to reject or accept a reservation of rights defense controls coverage, and here's why. Because if an insured rejects the reservation of rights defense, then the insurance company never has an opportunity to litigate coverage because
in that suit, they have plenty of opportunities in a separately filed action.
Well,
you don't litigate coverage in an underlying tort suit.
I agree with absolutely. I agree with that. But I mean, you would at a minimum, should have been had an opportunity to litigate it in this garnishment case. Mm-hmm. We should have had an opportunity to litigate it in the declaratory judgment actions, which were ultimately dismissed because of this garnishment case. That opportunity has never been provided to the insurance company. To say that the insurance company is bound by the findings of fact in a case that it could never have, it didn't have an opportunity, the insured refused
to
allow the defense.
Well, again, the only reason you didn't have an opportunity is because you did the reservation of rights. You had the opportunity.
Actually, I disagree with that because we didn't. An insurance company is entitled to offer the defense under a reservation of rights. The insured doesn't have to accept it, but if the insured rejects it, the insurance company then should be given an opportunity to say,
litigate coverage.
Defend outright, which then they're waiving all their coverage defenses, or don't defend, where then they're going to be bound by whatever factual determinations the insured and the plaintiff stipulate to. So, again, that's how the insured gets to dictate coverage, is if they reject the reservation of rights, then the insurance company either has to accept coverage, waive all its coverage defenses,
this is covered in lots of cases, but you're saying this goes beyond that, because there's lots of cases that address that and say the insured paid for the right to have the insurance company come in and defend, and if the insurance company makes the determination, we don't have coverage and we're going to take that risk by reserving rights, then you get the opportunity to file a deck action and litigate that issue, but you don't get to sit back and see how the underlying suit goes without being a part of it and then get to relitigate everything again. That's not what Missouri law provides for, or what the insurance
was. And what I'm saying is, I think this factual pattern is especially unique in light of the James versus Paul Cox versus Stecks cases. But I also think if we take the factual pattern of a permissive user of a motor vehicle, this is very basic, but if somebody steals my car and gets in an accident with, well, let's just say I'm going to use letters, A steals B's car and gets in an accident with C, C sues A, okay? A says, looks to B's insurance company and says, defend me. I was driving this car and you insured that car. And the insurance company says, no, you weren't defending, or you weren't driving that car with the permission of the insured. That's what our insured says, you didn't have permission. So then A and C enter into a stipulation where they go to the trial court and say, I was driving that car with the permission of the tort fees or of the insured. And all of a sudden, that somehow binds the insurance company to coverage under a policy where that person was a complete stranger to the policy.
Thank you. Your time is up. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
I appreciate it.
May it please the court. Your honors, what we haven't heard is what Attain should have done in this case. What they should have done and what they shouldn't have done. First of all, they shouldn't have denied coverage outright 48 hours after the first notice of the claim. The proper course, what Attain should have done in that situation, was say, thank you for putting us on notice. We're going to conduct a full, fair, and complete investigation. We'll get back to you as we further understand what the allegations are being brought by Franklin Allen. That's what Attain should have done in this case. What they could have done was file a declaratory judgment action in state court. Every single DJ, whether it was filed in federal court, was ultimately removed to federal court, and the federal court abstained because declaratory judgment jurisdiction in federal courts is citizens in a state court where there's a parallel state court proceeding is discretionary. So the federal court abstained from ruling because there is a pending state court action, and in fact, this state court here today is going to resolve those coverage issues. And for that very reason, the federal court said, we're staying out of it. And so what Attain should have done is stayed in state court and at least tried to get a stay via intervention in the underlying case. Now, the cases are correct that in the absence of a commitment for indemnity, typically there is no direct interest in it that would justify intervention. But what the cases do say is you're allowed to intervene for the limited purpose of requesting a stay. And that would have been exactly the right thing for Attain to do. Attain could have had a full and complete hearing on all of the coverage issues if they'd appealed the motion to intervene and brought in the supporting affidavits that said, look, there's a legitimate dispute here about what transpired that caused Franklin Allen to be shot.
What was the length of time between when they got notice of the lawsuit and when the consent judgment or the stipulations were entered?
Okay, now, there was never a consent judgment.
I apologize.
Yeah. It was a bench trial.
And there was the trial.
The stipulations she refers to were requests for admissions, which are an appropriate discovery vehicle. They're not a stipulation.
Again, I understand that. What's the length of time?
The Attain denied coverage on September 12th. Attain filed its DJ in federal court on October 22nd. There was an October 30th demand for the policy limits. The petition for damages was filed in the underlying case on December 4th.
And when was the judgment entered?
The judgment, the amended judgment was entered by Judge Torrance, or the order granting summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff, Garnishore, was July of 2014. The underlying judgment.
That's the one I'm asking.
Yes,
for
the underlying proceedings was the amended judgment entry of April 30th.
And when was the trial?
And the trial, the bench trial, occurred on April 18th.
I thought.
And when did Attain get notice of the filing, or when was the suit filed and Attain was given notice of the suit?
Well, Attain retained counsel to file an answer, so it was shortly after the suit was filed in December that they retained counsel. and had actual notice of the proceeding.
Ms. Canizzaro said they learned of the suit really too late in the process to have a chance to...
Well, they filed an answer. I'm not sure what's too late in the process then, because they'd already filed a DJ in federal court on October 22nd, and then the lawsuit, the underlying lawsuit, was filed on December 4th. She keeps making reference to an 065 being entered before the suit was even filed, but the 065 is nowhere in the legal file. It's nowhere in the underlying record in this case. And there's no best
filed.
Evidence.
It was never filed?
It was never filed. It's not of record anywhere in the legal file. It's not anywhere in the motions for summary judgments. It's nowhere attached.
Is there discussion of it in the file that says when it was...
I don't think there's any reference to, in fact, if the court cares to know, the 065 was in fact executed in January of 13. I mean, we could supplement as an exhibit or an appendix the 065, but it was never made a part of the proceedings to date.
Now, the insurance company supplemented their reservation of rights letter in a subsequent communication saying that they had done further investigation and found that they had no liability. What effect did that have on their duty to defend?
Right. That's an excellent question, because Attain, of course, insists that they never had the opportunity to defend, but in reality, they never defended under a reservation. They defended under a denial from the very outset. They denied it 48 hours after receiving notice. They denied it as a matter of law when they filed their DJ, saying that suing their insured and for a declaration of no coverage. And then they continued to deny coverage throughout.
They did have someone enter an appearance, so they were going to defend under reservation of rights.
Well, they say it's a reservation of rights, but what have they reserved? Typically, when you have covered and uncovered claims brought in an underlying proceeding, the carrier will say, if these allegations are proved to be true, we will indemnify you. Those were the only allegations that the plaintiff's counsel made in the underlying case, was specifically for a negligence action, not an intentional action.
Can you address the argument that this is more like James v. Paul, where you have three actors, not just two actors? So there's an agreement by two outside parties which takes this outside the normal insurance context.
I think what James v. Paul stands for, really, is that the defensive use of non-mutual collateral estoppel, when you have a guilty plea in a criminal proceeding, the insurance company can avail itself of that to subsequently bar a request for indemnity. Now, James v. Paul was a very divided court, but the majority opinion and Judge Holstein, that's exactly what they say. Unlike this case, where not only was there never a guilty plea, there was never even a charge brought. Mr. Breyers was never charged with a crime. The police investigated and held that they did not even refer it to the prosecutor's office. So unlike James v. Paul, there is no reduction to a judgment or plea that's conclusive from a collateral estoppel standpoint that would prevent Franklin Allen from litigating the coverage issue.
What about the allegations of fraud between the parties here that they say take it out of the normal range of cases?
You know, an 065 agreement does not constitute fraud. It's specifically authorized by statute. The factual findings are based upon the discovery and the evidence presented in a bench trial to Judge Torrance. He was the fact finder in that case.
They're saying they were conflicted and so couldn't properly offer a defense in the underlying action. Were they conflicted in a way different from the way insurers are always would like not to cover something, I mean, and yet do come in and defend? But was this case different because of the nature of the allegations?
The nature of the allegations would have mandated, and I think that would have been excellent grounds in support of a timely motion to intervene. The motion to intervene was filed before the judgment entry in the underlying case. And that would have been the appropriate time to have made the showing and say, hey, we have all this evidence. Our investigation revealed all these things, which we've still never seen in an effort by Attain to present.
And didn't they try to intervene and they were denied?
Yeah, they were denied, which you appeal. That's an appealable decision. And the case law is pretty clear that if there's a conflict and the court would be presented with evidence of conflict, and Attain came in and said, look, we can't really come in and say it was intentional without shooting our insured in the foot, so to speak. And because of that, in the underlying case, even though negligence is the only thing that's been alleged, which would be a covered claim, this is the exact reason, Your Honor, why we ought to have the DJ action resolved first. So if they'd filed it in state court, kept it in state court, and requested a stay, they could have moved for summary judgment in the declaratory judgment action, or as discovery progressed in the discovery judgment action, they say, hey, wait a minute, there is a dispute. Wayne Breyers does insist that this was an accident, that it was an accidental discharge because he was intoxicated.
And you're saying appeal. Do they have an immediate right of appeal, or you mean seek a writ?
Yes, they have an immediate, or either way. I mean, they would, because it's not a final judgment, it would have to be a writ of mandamus or prohibition to keep the trial court from.
Do they have to pursue that, or can they rely on the trial court's determination they didn't have an interest that would be impaired by the case they were seeking in a writ?
Yeah, they do have to appeal that. That's why the courts say that it's a final appealable order, because that is would be the appropriate time to wage that war instead of just insisting on your denial, instead of trying to defend under a denial, which is what they did throughout. So they get in for the limited purposes of requesting a stay, and there's several procedural cases that have come before the appellate level courts that are in exactly that posture. That is, the trial court stayed the underlying damage suit and allowed the DJ to proceed, and so that there could be a determination of coverage. And if I were a teen, I'd come in and say, Judge, look, we're between a rock and a hard place. We can't raise our coverage defense without spoiling the defense for our insured in the underlying case. So we can't really provide them with a good defense by our retained counsel while we're hamstrung on coverage issues. That's why we ought to let the DJ go first. And had they had a DJ filed in a court that didn't abstain from jurisdiction, there's no reason they couldn't have done that. And that's what brings us to today, is effectively, that is where we are today. And today, Attain's never filed a motion for summary judgment in the garnishment proceeding or in any other proceeding. They've never asked a court to go ahead and say, hey, we were right in denying all the way along the line. At best, all they can do is say there's a factual dispute, which tacitly admits that there are facts to support covered allegations. And when the only allegations that were made in the underlying case are covered, unlike Cox v. Streck, where they alleged an intentional assault and alternatively negligence, that's the conflict. That would be the conflict where they're stuck on that, because they can't. The retained counsel would have a difficult time resisting its master and running for the intentional rabbit hole because that precludes coverage. That would be a terrible conflict. In this case, that did not exist because of the way the allegations were pled. Carriers all the time are faced with covered and uncovered claims, sometimes covered claims but uncovered damages. The traditional case is a drunk driver causes a vehicular accident. He's liable for potentially actual and punitive damages. What does the responsible carrier do? Under Advantage Builders, it gives them a clear, timely, accurate statement of what's covered and what's not. And they say, we will indemnify you up to the policy limit for the allegations as it relates to the claims for actual damages. We reserve the right, however, in fact, we're going to tell you right now that punitive damages are not covered, and you need to go get your own lawyer, and you need to take such steps to protect yourself as you deem necessary on that. That's what responsible, appropriate insurance companies do. They don't just deny coverage 48 hours after they get the first notice, and they don't insist on that denial and attempt to control the defense. That's worse than defending under a reservation of rights. Here they're defending under a denial. And our case law has consistently held, most recently in Columbia Casualty, that that is a breach of the duty to defend. When you have nothing but covered claims, and when you admit that there are at least allegations factually that are going to support indemnity, then to abandon your insured by not providing coverage for those covered claims puts you at risk. All our case law says that. Even Cox v. Streck, Steck says, we do not disagree with the well-settled principle that an insurer who elects not to defend an insured under a contractual duty should be bound by the underlying judgment if its decision concerning coverage is wrong. So if Attain had done what a responsible carrier should have done, which is say, we're investigating, and then when they got the allegations in the petition, they should have said, if these allegations prove true, we're going to indemnify you. If the allegations change and the claimant alleges that you intended this act, it's excluded under the policy because of the intentional act exclusion or the assault and battery exclusion. That's what responsible carriers do. Attain did not do that. They never did that. They routinely incorporated their original denial. And it's that kind of insurance doublespeak that doesn't provide the claimant with a clear indication of where they are in the proceeding.
But Breyer's liability to the tort plaintiff is the same whether it's intentional or negligent. And when you have a pre-filing agreement between those two and filings that just happen to line up exactly with coverage, why doesn't that take it out of the normal course of events that you just described?
Okay. First, there's no pre-filing agreement. There's no evidence of that in the record. It keeps being referred to, but there's no 065.
I understand.
And that's the best evidence
of
when this
gets
in.
January of 13.
I beg your pardon?
You just told us it was in January of 13.
Yeah. That's not pre-filing. That's pre-judgment. But, of course, you have to do it pre-judgment by the statute. Once it's liquidated, you lose the benefit of 065. So the terms of 537065 require the agreement to be made prior to the entry of judgment. The pre-filing, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I lost track. I got
where the allegations are targeted to coverage and not liability to the tort plan. That seems to be
so
the concern.
That goes really to the fundamental question of was everything in the underlying judgment on the up and up? And it's always true. It was true from the moment that Wayne Breyers went down to the police station and he gave a statement to the police. And he said, look, I didn't mean to shoot him. I was drunk. The gun went off. But I never meant to shoot him. I didn't even mean to pull the trigger. And so if those are the facts, if Wayne Breyers admits those when he's requested to do so, and if he admits that he was an employee of the apartment, which he was, and if he admits that his employer told him he could pack a weapon for the protection of his person and the property because of the neighborhood and the prior events, then all of those things are true.
If they're able to prove fraud as opposed to the facts that you've just talked about, Do they get a chance to litigate that, to claim that there was collusion beyond simply someone not wanting to have a huge judgment against them, so signing an 065 agreement?
Competing evidence does not constitute fraud.
No, I know that. And of course it does not. But what if there was a case where there was fraud? Is that something the insurer has a venue in which they can raise?
Sure. You allege an affirmative defense of fraud, and then you plead in your answer or in the...
In which case? In the garnishment?
In the garnishment action, sure. Okay. In the garnishment action. And you say, we can't be bound by the underlying judgment because it was procured by fraud because they perpetrated an untruth on the court. And here's what it is. And here's how they did it. That's the allegations and the factual support you need for that affirmative defense to fly. And there's just no record of that in the case. The only record in the case is that Wayne Breyer's version of events from the beginning was ultimately found by the trial court to be the version that led to the underlying judgment and to the indemnifiable pleading made by Franklin Allen to recover for his injuries. And we discuss in our brief the distinction between negligence claims and intentional claims and that they are mutually inconsistent and they cannot be in... they can't be both. They can be one or the other.
Are there any other questions?
When and where did they litigate the issue they raised that their policy was voided by the carrying of the weapon?
You know, that an affirmative defense of rescission, I think, I believe, Your Honor. And you've got to raise that as an affirmative defense. You've got to tell the policyholder that. You've got to rescind the policy and refund the premium. All of which there's no record of, and frankly, it never took place.
They sent a letter voiding the policy.
They sent a letter denying coverage, but they never returned the premium or did any of the other acts necessary to effectuate a rescission.
And they didn't rescind the policy, they just denied coverage.
They just denied coverage.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just start by addressing the 065 agreement, because there is ample evidence under this court's standard of review for the 065 agreement. What is in the record is a correspondence from plaintiff's counsel wherein he indicates in November of 2012, before the tort action was filed, that he was that the plaintiff and Mr. Breyers were agreeing to an 065 agreement. Then subsequent to that, when Attain attempted to defend Mr. Breyers, they received correspondence from Mr. Breyers' personal counsel indicating, we've already entered an 065 agreement, we'll be consenting to judgment in accord with that 065 agreement.
And when did that occur?
That letter, the letter that we received would have been in January 10th or 11th of 2012. The first letter that talked about the fact that they'd agreed to 065 was in November of 2012.
But Mr. Presley said they filed the 065 in January, and that wasn't signed till then, whatever.
They didn't file it ever. They've refused to produce it. And for them to come into court and claim some benefit of failure for the defendant or the insurance company to put in that evidence is wrong.
What's the docket sheet show? With the
there file? Is no filing could of you, the 065 agreement.
Could you have discovered the 065 agreement if you'd have filed your declaratory judgment in state court and left it there?
We attempted to discover the 065 agreement.
In the state declaratory judgment proceeding?
In the state declaratory judgment proceeding. We did not get it. That proceeding was ultimately removed to federal court, but we were never given.
Did you remove it to federal court?
I did remove it to federal court.
Did you send a letter saying you didn't, you were willing to defend under reservation of rights, or did you deny but then try? But then try to offer a defense despite having outright denied.
We sent a letter offering a defense under a reservation of rights starting in September of 2012. We said a suit's not been filed. Obviously the duty to defend can't, we don't say it in the letter, but obviously the duty to defend can't exist till the suit's filed. But if a suit's filed, we will defend you. Send us a copy, we'll defend you. Then as soon as we get notice of it, we send another letter saying, hey, guess what? We found out that a suit's been filed. You may not know, but we will defend you. Here's the lawyer that
under a reservation of rights?
Under a reservation of rights. So back to the 065. Under the summary judgment standard in this case, there's evidence in the record in the light most favorable to the insurance company that an 065 agreement was entered as far back as November of 2012. At least the terms of those were in agreement. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever in the record that it was entered in January of 2012.
The cases say that you're saying you had a right to intervene as a matter of right?
You can attempt to intervene as a matter of right, but ultimately what the recent appellate court cases say is that's a discretionary matter, it's abuse of discretion, and quite frankly, all of the recent cases say it's not an abuse of discretion for the trial judge.
If it's a matter of right, there's no discretion.
I agree with that, but I'm telling
you. I mean, there's a 2014 case saying you can immediately appeal denial. If your claim is you had a right to intervene as a matter of right, and that was denied, you can appeal that immediately, but you did not. Now, the court may disagree or may agree, but you need to appeal that at the time. It's an appealable order, not a writ, but an appealable order.
It would be an appealable order, but ultimately what the case law says under that scenario is that it's a discretionary. The appeal is not discretionary.
It's permissive intervention, not an intervention.
Right. It doesn't become an intervention. The right does not ripen until there's a judgment against the tortfeasor and the insurance company is called upon to indemnify. That's what's required in order for that right to actually come to fruition.
And then you tried to intervene after the judgment that was also denied. And
correct.
Did you appeal that?
And we appealed that, and that's presently before the court.
Okay. But you're appealing the garnishment, but not the intervention, denial of intervention?
We appeal the denial of intervention as well, because that was in the garnishment action as well. I've got about a minute left. I want to address one of the scenarios that...
Actually, the time's going up as opposed to down.
Oh, I'm sorry. If there are no more questions, I appreciate everybody's time and attention.
Everybody does that. Okay.
Thank you. Case will be submitted. Thank you both for a well-argued case.